Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Dissidents and Dictators, the flagship podcast from the Human Rights Foundation. My name is Casey Michelle, and alongside my stellar co-host, Alicia Maldonado. Say hi, Alicia.
Hello, it's me.
We have a treat for listeners today. We don't have a guest, but we do have a very important topic that we will be covering, and that is my forthcoming book, Foreign Agents, which is all about the threats of the foreign lobbying industry in the United States and how these American foreign lobbyists have become the best friends dictators around the world could ask for. So stick around, because we have got plenty to cover. Hi, Alicia. How are you doing today?
I am doing well. How about you?
Good. Welcome back from your global travels.
Traveling all over.
I hear you have been seeing the world and telling everyone that I look like a certain singer named Michael Bublé.
Michael Bublé. It is true. You do. And you've got the fresh haircut today, really accentuating that Michael Bublé-esqueness.
Well, that's what I told the barber when I went. I said, make me Bublé. Or
make me even more Bublé. Yeah.
But, know, it is what it is. So I'm trying to avoid as many mirrors as I can.
Oh, and try not to sway a lot, you know.
Wow. Yeah. We're having fun. We're off to the races already.
Yeah, it's been fun traveling about. And it was in Italy and had a nice long jaunt home. So the more I travel, the goal is to just not get sick like I was all of last month for everyone who was listening.
Not ideal, especially when it comes to losing your voice and trying to run a podcast
as
well.
I thought that was a very cool moment personally. It showed very, you know, different personalities and colors.
Well, it's a lot of fortitude.
Yeah.
A lot of bravery.
Yeah.
And really taught me a lot about you as well. Well, I'm so proud to have you as my podcast partner today.
And I will work through illness.
Not least because now that you're better, you can ask me about the important thing in my life.
Yes.
And you're
not talking about me and Talia, who's producing for us today.
No, of course not.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the second most important thing after you and Talia, of course.
Oh, okay. So the book, not the wife and the baby.
Mainly the book at this point in terms of what is taking up most of my time. It's basically like a baby as well for anyone.
It is, yeah.
Who's written a book, you know that it is like, you don't get any love back. There's no affection you get back, so it's in many ways worse than a kid.
But it looks pretty on a shelf and on our desk.
Well, I'd like to shout out the cover jacket designers from my publisher, St. Martin's Press, who've done truly a phenomenal job making this book look far more interesting than it certainly was when it was just a blank page on my Word doc. But with the private jet right there, the mysterious men sauntering off to meet God knows who, God knows where, to pocket millions of dollars from some dictatorship, some regime, some authoritarian that is working against democracy, not just in their country, but globally as well. You know, this is who these foreign lobbyists are, and this is what they have been doing for years and years, which I think the cover itself does capture.
I think so, too. It looks really cool, and it's an accompaniment to your first book, American Kleptocracy, which hits on the same sort of themes, because what makes the world go round but money? Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us about some of your main findings in this one and some of the main characters.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, you're exactly right, Alicia. I mean, this second book is very much a compliment. My first one was focused, again, on the United States of America, but primarily how the American economy had opened itself through a series of very particular policy decisions and loopholes that have been on the books for decades, how the American economy was really opened up to all kinds of illicit wealth, dirty money, dictatorial, looted, ill-gotten gains that traveled the world, were stolen from populations, immiserating entire nations while entrenching those regimes, and then moving that money into the United States of America. And what ended up happening with that money? How was it hidden? How was it laundered? And beyond that, how did it degrade and in some cases destroy democracy that much further? Again, in these home countries, but increasingly in the democratic world itself. That was the first book.
Right.
This second book is very much an outgrowth of the research into that one. And the story that first one tried to tell as well, because again, it's not just that money is ending up in, you know, things like real estate or things like private equity, hedge funds, things like universities. It's not just that money is staying there, but that money, as the second book describes, all too often also goes to a specific subset of the American economy, a very specific industry itself in the United States, and that is the foreign lobbying industry based primarily, but not only, but primarily in Washington, D.C. It is an industry that is now worth billions of dollars, has truly exploded over the past decade, and is comprised of a range of different entities and players and policies, all of which are under the broader rubric of foreign lobbying, all of whom are servicing, all of whom are working hand in glove with, have become the effective foot soldiers and henchmen for, in some cases, henchwomen, so I guess hench people, for, again, the most notorious, the most horrific, and the most anti-democratic regimes in the world, destroying those democracies back in those home countries, while again increasingly turning their sights on degrading democracy in the United States of America and the broader democratic world itself. So again, it's a relatively familiar story in terms of how some of these networks flow and operate, but it is brand new. It's very unique in what's actually talking about in terms of the details, in terms of the players, in terms of the policies, and in terms of this industry itself.
Well, a potentially dumb question. How does one become a lobbyist, a foreign lobbyist? How do you sort of get into that business initially? Because I just can't imagine, I'm going to go to school and I'm going to do this, you know, like, maybe it's just political science. Maybe it's a dumb question. I don't know.
It has been a difficult journey for me to try to put myself in the shoes of some of these figures.
Yeah.
And again, we're talking about the Americans, right? Mm-hmm. I say foreign lobbyists. These are American lobbyists who are working for foreign regimes, foreign governments. I mean, the short answer is that anyone and everyone in the United States of America can become a foreign lobbyist. So, Elise, say you decide to wake up tomorrow and be a completely different person, a far less admirable, in many ways, far more loathsome person, with significantly less shame, significantly more willingness to, again, work for anyone and everyone around the world, regardless of how they made their wealth, regardless of what regime they may be working for. If you wake up tomorrow and you say, by golly, I want to be a foreign lobbyist, I want to be a foreign agent, the good news, or bad news, depending on your vantage, is that you can absolutely do that. No strings attached. I mean, I think one of the things that the book goes into the detail of is lobbying, for as sordid of a reputation as it has, in the United States of America, it's still a constitutionally protected right. In the very First Amendment of the American Constitution. Again, the First Amendment, traditionally known for a lot of folks, are aware that, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly. But there's also the freedom to petition the government for the redress of grievances, which is kind of a long, convoluted, maybe even archaic at this point, way of saying you can go talk to your legislators about whatever you want.
Right.
You can organize conversations with these legislators, certainly at the state level, but as well as in Congress, in the House and in Senate, and certainly in the administration itself, to try to push for interests that you carry, that you and your colleagues think is of note or is important, or in the case of foreign agents and foreign lobbyists, the interests of those foreign governments who are paying you to do this. So it is perfectly legal. It is constitutionally protected. And unfortunately, foreign regimes have realized that, taken full advantage of it, and all too often found these Americans who are as shameless as the day is long. One of the chapter titles is a quote from one of the lobbyists that I describe in the book. He's this super flamboyant gentleman. He likes wearing a cape. He represented everyone from Saddam Hussein to, you know, truly the most, you know, horrific regimes you could imagine on the planet. His quote, which was one of the chapter titles, is "Shame is for sissies," which, you know, is certainly one way to phrase it.
That's a worldview.
I think it encapsulates exactly the ethos that so many of these foreign lobbyists embody.
I mean, can they just go back to lobbying for cigarettes?
Well, that's certainly an option. And I do think, again, it's worth highlighting. This is something that was evident in the first book as well. Is much of this new book focuses on the explosion, the real true explosion of the foreign lobbying industry over the past two, maybe even three decades at this point. It's really a post-Cold War phenomenon. And the industry is really coming into its own in the 21st century. But it didn't exist. It didn't arise from a vacuum. There were networks. There was the kind of infrastructure that was already evident through much of the late 20th century, focused primarily at that point on domestic clientele. So yes, the cigarette mm-hmm. industry, but so much more. The, you know, energy and hydrocarbons, business writ large. You know, these firms arose in Washington to lobby legislators for their clients.
Right.
And those clients were domestic. They were American companies or American figures. And then fast forward to the 21st century, those American firms realized, well, we don't have to service just the cigarette companies or the, you know, whatever it might be, the American company. We can also work for the Russias, the Chinas, the mm-hmm. Irans, the oligarchs, the kleptocrats, the arms traffickers, the narco traffickers of the world. They can be our clients too. You know, unless those figures are sanctioned by the U.S. government, there's nothing stopping these American firms from ushering these truly horrific regimes, mm-hmm. you know, in many ways, scum of the earth kind of figures into right. the halls of Washington, making millions of dollars along the way and opening the doors to legislators for these clients.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so we're kind of dancing around, you know, why this is such an important, why it's such an important topic right now. Why this book now? You know, you're mentioning some of those big players, the Russias, the UAE sort of guys. Go into that a little bit for us.
Well, one answer to that is, I mean, there's a few ways of approaching it. One answer to that is because of the magnitude of the industry itself. Mm. If you go back 20, 25 years when the industry itself was really getting going, I mean, frankly, we've had foreign lobbyists in the country for going on about a century now. The book goes into actually some 19th century instances, but it wasn't really until the 1930s when you had Nazi-related efforts to target and sway Americans, including American legislators, that we finally had legislation on the books regarding foreign lobbyists, foreign agents registration. I mean, the big piece of legislation in the book is literally known as the Foreign Agents Registration mm-hmm. Act. And that's been on the books since the 1930s. But it wasn't until the 21st century that we saw this tsunami of money coming into the United States to hire these lobbyists. And when I think it's worth backing up again, because when I'm talking about lobbyists, it's not just those traditional firms. It's also public relations professionals.
Right.
It's consultants. It is former members of Congress who leave office and become lobbyists themselves, who are the experts on navigating committees, navigating who to talk to, navigating right. how to craft policy that these dictatorships
go in the back doors.
Go in the back doors, exactly. As well as increasingly groups like think tanks, universities, and more in the nonprofit sector. I mean, some even just literal nonprofits that have opened their doors, transformed into launching pads for lobbying for these foreign regimes themselves. So again, when we're talking about lobbying, it's not just traditional lobbyists. It's now all these others that also comprise lobbying. And again, now worth billions and billions of dollars. Some of the biggest spenders, again, China, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, you know, again, very bloodied regimes
right.
that have no basic freedoms domestically. I mean, China is engaging in genocide against its Uyghur population. I mean, you can't get more horrific than some of these countries. So that's one element, just the magnitude of the industry itself. And the second, and this is maybe putting my American hat on a little mm-hmm. bit more, is because unfortunately, this industry, even though we had legislation on the books, it was barely, if ever, enforced. The industry and the transparency requirements were there, you know, again, supposed to be things that these foreign lobbyists were following, but no one was paying attention. We really left the barn door open for these guys.
Yeah.
And what we saw by the early to mid-2010s is that all of a sudden they were so ingrained in and ingratiated with legislators in Washington that by 2015, 2016, 2017, some of these foreign agents were catapulted to the highest ranks of the American policymaking community. Mm-hmm. So they're no longer just lobbyists on the outside trying to target specific officials. Now all of a sudden they're inside of the White House
right.
crafting policy, crafting presidential speeches, opening the doors again to the highest rungs of the American policymaking community. And oh, by the way, they're also doing this in Congress. There's a, you know, folks may be following the news in the next week or two. There's going to be a new trial in the United States for a Democratic senator. He's still a member of the Senate. Bob Menendez from the right. great state of New Jersey. It's the very first time in American history we've seen a sitting senator go on trial for secretly working as a foreign lobbyist. In his case, working for the regimes in Egypt and Qatar. But some of the main figures in the book itself are those that attach themselves to what at the time was then candidate Donald Trump's first campaign, not Trump himself, but those members of his inner circle, including his campaign manager, Paul Manafort, who is a key figure, worked for regimes in the Philippines, in Nigeria, most especially, most spectacularly, the pro-Kremlin leader in Ukraine, who was then ousted in 2014 and sparked everything we've seen in Ukraine ever since. He was Trump's campaign manager in 2016. Now, eventually prosecuted for foreign lobbying charges, among a number of other charges, but also eventually pardoned, unfortunately, by then-President Trump. So we have the money, but we also have who these guys, and almost they're generally guys themselves, although there are a few women that do feature in the book, what they were able to actually achieve for themselves in terms of political access by the mid-2010s and even through the late 2010s. That's why I wrote this book.
Can you tell us about some of the creative or, quote, fun ways that they've gone about some of their lobbying?
You know, you have
to— there are stories you can't believe in a way.
There are stories that you can't believe. In a way, this will bring it back to kind of my work in this space and how I ended up started writing about these foreign agents, these foreign lobbyists. I've had more experiences than I ever thought I would on those who are working on behalf of the regime, not in Russia or China or Saudi, but in Azerbaijan, which is really continues to be this overlooked but really quintessential kleptocratic regime that has done phenomenally innovative work in terms of laundering its reputation. So one of the things that they did, and this will date me, but I was back in grad school. No, sorry, I was working as a journalist back in 2013. I was living in the beautiful city of Houston, Texas. And Azerbaijan had opened up a kind of a sister city, you know, local cultural center there, because Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, and Houston are sister cities. And anyways, I'm doing this, you know, relatively soft story on this new cultural center. What is Azerbaijan? Where is it? And the woman who was running it, you know, she comes to me after I'm done and she says, look, we appreciate you writing on this. We're so happy. We're organizing a congressional junket, some members of Congress, to come to Azerbaijan in a few months. Would you like to come? Would you like to come over and cover it? We think it'd be good for your newspaper. And I said, look, I think that'd be interesting. Let me talk to my editor about it. And she says, that's great. Oh, by the way, obviously we'll be paying for all of your travel, your flights, your hotels. And I said, oh, okay. And she says, and of course, we wouldn't want you to write anything negative about the country, about the— she didn't say it, but the decades-long hereditary dictatorship that targets members of the press, targets ethnic and religious minorities, so on and so forth. And I go, oh, okay, yeah, sure. Let me talk to my editor about that. Needless to say, I didn't go.
Of course.
Unfortunately, not that I would have ever accepted that offer, I do regret not being there, because what ended up happening is not only was that the biggest congressional trip to the entire Caucasus region ever, but that ended up blowing up into the most spectacular ethics and foreign lobbying related investigation in congressional history. And this is maybe going to spoil a little bit of the book. What happened is, because it wasn't the Azeri government nominally funding it, there was a technical nonprofit registered in the state of Texas that was a front for the government. And it turns out the House Ethics Committee was completely asleep at the wheel, had no interest in investigating where this money was coming from, and it blew up in their faces. And you have these high-profile investigations into saying, in effect, who the hell is funding this? What are they getting from it?
Right.
And what does that mean for legislators in the United States of America, who then came back to Washington and suddenly started spouting off all of these things about how Azerbaijan is a friend of democracy, it's a transitioning democracy, we should lift sanctions, so on and so forth. Yeah. Look, I mean, this is— I could go on and on and on about how the Azeri lobbyists have been, in many ways, old friends of mine and those that keep popping up in my life. But I think that story really suffices to say, sometimes it does get just ridiculous, and suddenly you realize you're right there on the receiving end of some of these efforts.
Yeah, and they're very slick too. So you have to really be kind of, you know, on your feet in front of those. I mean, I've had similar, you know, experiences with junkets and being invited on junkets, and I've done a couple, but only when I was able to say, and I will not be writing anything that I, you know, that is not true or that I don't see for myself. I won't be writing anything flattering just because this is the thing that you've invited us on.
It is. So, yeah. It is a— it's funny, because one of the things that folks can see, if they would like, is how these foreign lobbyists actually directly target journalists themselves. The beauty, again, one of the main reasons I was able to write this book is because the beauty of the American legislation, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, mm-hmm. is that there is an online database. And this is what I recommend for anyone, listeners, readers, so on and so forth, in the U.S. or anywhere else, is to go to the department, the U.S. Department of Justice website. You know, you can just Google it, DOJ, Foreign Agents Registration Act, and you will be brought to their database, which is open access, which is perfectly accessible and easy mm-hmm. to navigate. And you can look by country, you can look by firm, you can look at you know, the timeline, whatever you want. At what these foreign agents, these foreign lobbyists are doing,
yeah.
how much they are being paid, who they are connecting with, who are they contacting, what are they publishing, you know, whether you are in Azerbaijan, whether you're in Angola, whether you're in, you know, wherever it might be, you can see what your government is doing with these American lobbyists, these American foreign agents. And then beyond that, maybe which journalists they are contacting, mm-hmm. who are they emailing, what are they emailing. There is just a world of information that I was able to access, I was able to yeah. use much of for this book. But in many ways, I'm just really scratching the surface. And other journalists, other researchers, other
yeah.
constituents elsewhere, you know, that material is perfectly open and perfectly accessible.
I think that one of the first times you and I met and we had the conversation, you told I grew up in Cheyenne, Wyoming, of all places. Very small state, no one knows really exists. But you told me that there was a house, I can't remember which country, was
Ukraine.
Was it Ukraine? Yeah. And I knew that street and just never would think that Ukraine would be thinking about little Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Not that I need to sell Cheyenne on anyone. I mean, it's lovely. Obviously, Wyoming is an incredibly beautiful state itself.
Watch your dog run away for days.
Cheyenne, Wyoming, you know, the state capital, you know, it was small, but I was there a few years ago mm. for one particular story to go to this just little out-of-the-way house between a barbershop and a church, you know, completely nondescript. You'd never notice it if you drove by. But this was home for, I don't remember how many dozens of shell companies connected to the gentleman who was then the prime minister in Ukraine. This was back in the 1990s before Ukraine's democratic reformations and multiple democratic revolutions, that he used Cheyenne, Wyoming as his little financial getaway vehicle. And what's funny about that is, so that connects really to the first book in terms of the financial secrecy networks. But what we have seen is so many of those anti-democratic forces in places like Ukraine, mm-hmm. and this really is another reason I ended up writing this book right now, is because so many Americans were brought to Ukraine and then ended up lobbying American legislators on behalf of not the democratic forces in Ukraine, but the pro-Russian, pro-Kremlin, anti-democratic mm-hmm. forces in Kyiv. You know, there was a former president, Viktor Yanukovych, who was ousted mm-hmm. from power in 2014, and his best bud and his best weapon in many ways was that figure I mentioned a moment ago, Paul Manafort,
uh-huh.
who constructed this entire edifice of Americans, frankly, across the political spectrum. I mean, even though Manafort ended up working for a Republican candidate, he still hired all of these figures who had worked for Democratic candidates, mm-hmm. As well as those that were more centrist as well, all of whom could target all these different elements of the American policymaking community to say, look, you don't have to worry about Kremlin interests in Ukraine. You don't have to worry about this guy Yanukovych. Again, he's a democratic figure. He had some tough times over there, but you got to cut on some slack. Don't be so critical of this guy. And then obviously, lo and behold, this guy Yanukovych ends up unleashing a hail of bullets on all of these democratic protesters, kills at least 100 of them. And then, you know, here we are 10 years later and Ukraine is still in many ways in flames. Suffering from Russian aggression because of the Yanukovych regime and what Manafort and his whole coterie, his whole cadre of Americans, these lobbyists, were able to do back in the late 2000s and early 2010s.
I mean, it's impressive, however dastardly it is, to pull that together. I mean,
it certainly is. And look, again, at the end of the day, we putting my American hat back on, we left ourselves wide open mm-hmm. for this. Even yeah. though we had the legislation, it was never enforced. There was never any interest. Again, you know, we thought we were in this post-Cold War, you know, there might be issues. Yeah, there might be. But everyone's transitioning toward a kind of liberal democracy. We don't need to worry about these foreign lobbyists. What are they going to do at the end of the day? Everyone's mm-hmm. working in this toward this kind of democratic trajectory and direction. And here we are, lo and behold. And, you know, we see dictatorship on the march. We see democracy on its back heels in many cases, in many ways. And we see continued today. It's still perfectly legal.
Yep.
For these foreign agents, foreign lobbyists, to act as the foot soldiers and the mouthpieces, the man on the ground, for, again, the most anti-democratic regimes on the planet.
It's unbelievable, Casey. Yes. Yeah. Well, the book is Foreign Agents, How American Lobbyists and Lawmakers Threaten Democracy Around the World. When's it out?
It comes out in August. The reason we're talking about it right now is because this week officially marks the launch of the, which I'm sure will get very annoying very fast, all the posting, all the messaging, certainly from me and others about when this book is coming out and why folks should pick up a copy. So go online, pre-order it now.
Yeah, we'll link it in the show notes.
Available for all your favorite bookstores, booksellers, and absolutely learn a little bit more about this regime, what they may be doing on behalf of whatever country you may be interested in or you may be from, and beyond that, what that means for democracy on this planet.
How'd you get so smart, Casey?
I don't know anything about any kind of smarts. I don't really remember writing this. Very much an author's fog, but hey, yeah. I have a copy right in front of me, so apparently I did it at some point. But I will say, Alish, I did get, I don't know how smart I am, but I do feel like I get smarter every day by sitting across the table from you.
So, oh, I feel the same way.
Thanks for that. Oh, also Talia, our wonderful
Talia
producer.
Too. Yeah. Well, look forward to the book. Proud of you.
Thanks, Alish.
Talk to you next week.
All right. See you then.
Bye. The Human Rights Foundation is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that promotes and protects human rights globally, with a focus on closed societies. We promote freedom where it's most at risk, in countries ruled by authoritarian regimes.